hospital, then if the physician feels aggrieved, he can petition directly to the circuit court for a de novo review. Now, it has been suggested to me by several that the de novo review isn't specific enough in that it doesn't say your de novo review for what? What are you reviewing? And so we may want to add three items on page 2, line 37 and 38, and we could say that the court shall consider the matter de novo upon the record, but upon petition of any party, the court shall consider all additional relevant evidence, and then state that the scope of review shall be to determine, one, whether there was substantial compliance with the procedural provisions of the medical staff bylaws. Now, each of the medical staffs have what they call a fair hearing type of bylaw, which is required under the Wyden Act. And so the court, in its de novo review, would be looking to see whether the procedural steps were followed, and number two, whether, in fact, the petitioner was, in fact, in violation of the medical staff bylaws or rules and regulations, as alleged. And then three, whether the sanctions imposed were reasonable under the circumstances. So I think that might give some comfort to the some of the people that thought that the unlimited de novo was too broad, and it gives some guidelines to the court as to what it is it's looking at. It's going to see if the bylaw procedures were followed, whether there were in fact violations of the bylaws as charged, and whether or not the sanctions were reasonable. So with that, we support the bill.
Thank you very much. I assume you'll get those in writing to us.
Yes.
And are there questions of Mr. Cooney? Thank you very much. Karen Creason.
Good evening. My name is Karen Creason, and I'm an attorney in Portland in private practice, and I'm here because I deal principally with health law issues, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Association of Hospitals. I speak in opposition to this bill, not because it may not be well-intentioned to fill immunity gaps, but because I think it effectively takes hospitals out of real peer review and substitutes courts, and that the cure would be worse than the problem. I think it might be helpful to go just a few minutes further into the history of how we got here, because I think it illustrates why the problem isn't quite addressed by the solution that's proposed. When the federal court started holding people like doctors, lawyers, all the professionals subject to antitrust laws and holding that they were subject to damages under that, the Patrick case came along and really shook all of the physicians, in fact, all of the hospitals as well, because it basically said that this wonderful peer review statute everyone had been relying on might not be the protection they thought they had. I think you have to know that that peer review statute is intricately interwoven with your hospital licensing law. And that licensing law says that to hold a license in this state, the governing body of the healthcare facility is to be responsible for selecting the medical staff for the quality of care rendered in the facility, recognizing that the lay members of boards don't often have the real capability of hearing all that out. The licensing law goes further and mandates that every healthcare institution organize the healthcare practitioners that provide care there, that have access to use the facility, and require them to perform peer review to look for incompetence, errors, bad procedural techniques, lack of qualifications, unprofessional conduct, all the kinds of things that you would like to see healthcare professionals monitored for effectively. And that statute, which is ORS 441055, requires the hospitals to ensure that the physicians admitted to practice at their facility are organized in that manner to effectively do the peer review. Physicians were reluctant to do so if what they said in those proceedings could be used for other purposes, ancillary purposes like lawsuits, particularly if those lawsuits were going to be against them. And that's why ORS 41675 interties with the hospital licensing law. It basically assures all those people who are being required to participate that what they say and do there is not going to be discoverable or admissible in any lawsuit, and that the people serving on and communicating to those committees are not going to be subject to damage, civil damages, for the actions they take in those proceedings in good faith. The court said at that time, and have said since, that if the process is inappropriate, misused, not carried out appropriately, you can come to court for a review of the fairness of the proceeding to test the procedures that were used. Did you have a fair opportunity? That's been the law in this state for a long time. In the Straube case, which goes back all the way to the 70s, a physician who felt he had been wronged by the peer review process did exactly that. The physicians who felt they'd been deprived of that immunity that they thought they'd had under state law went to Congress, and they got the Healthcare Quality Improvement Act, which was just referred to as the Wyden Act, passed. It reinstated a good chunk of the immunity they'd lost for the bodies that are doing the peer review, for the members on those, for the people assisting them, for the people who give them evidence. None of those are liable in damages if they follow the procedures of that act. There are a few exclusions, and they're pretty important exclusions for civil rights. They're exclusions for people who aren't physicians and dentists. So if you're deciding the privileges of a nurse practitioner or a chiropractor or a podiatrist or a lot of other folks, it doesn't cover. And it doesn't cover government enforcement actions. But other than that, it's a broad immunity statute if you follow the procedures that are specified. To get that immunity, you have to be undertaking peer review in a reasonable belief that what you're going to do is going to further quality health care, and you have to make a reasonable effort to get the facts and give people adequate notice and hearing process. Witnesses and sources of information got even better protection under that federal act. They got protection unless they literally lied about a fact and knew at the time they were telling it that it wasn't true. So that's where we were with the federal protection to sort of deal with this federal problem of antitrust liability.
And this is, when was that?
That's a 1986 act. Thank you. This legislature opted to have Oregon covered under that act for both, not only just for federal causes of action, but for the state causes of action several years ago. So it's been in effect a number of years. That act leaves some gaps. There's no question about it. I don't disagree with that. It leaves gaps if you're worried about being sued by non-physicians and non-dentists. It leaves gaps if you're worried about being sued about civil rights violations. It leaves gaps if you don't plan to comply with the procedures. You're going to do something without a reasonable belief that it's necessary and without fair procedure and fair notice. Though there are gaps there. But the overlapping immunities that are there mean that there's an awful lot of protection there too, and more important, I think, that there's a procedure to be followed there, already there. The act that you're looking at, or the bill that you're looking at, has two parts to it, I think. One deals with the immunity that Senator Shoemaker addressed. The other part deals with procedures. Getting witness lists, subpoenaing people, getting documents, the sort of how you conduct the peer review in the peer review proceeding, as well as an additional court review after that peer review proceeding is over. Well, the federal government has already very adequately addressed what you need to do in the peer review proceeding. Amongst the other things that act requires is notice to the physician that a particular action is proposed against him, a statement of the reasons for the action to be taken, a summary of the physician's rights to a hearing to review the action with stated time limits, a means to request such a review, notice of the date, time, and place it will be held, at least 30 days to prepare for it, a list of witnesses the hospital intends to call against him, a hearing panel which excludes the direct economic competitors, which was the problem in the famous Patrick case. They didn't exclude the direct economic competitors. Well, the federal government has now said you got to do that. A right to be represented by an attorney or person of your choice. a verbatim record, a court reporter, to take the whole thing down, a right to call and cross-examine witnesses, a right to present relevant evidence, to submit memoranda, to get a copy of a written decision telling you what was decided and the basis. There are a lot of rights in there and a lot of procedures. So if we look at this bill as a discovery bill, get more information, get more process in the peer review process, number one, the federal act already well covers what the process needs to be. It's totally unnecessary. It includes things like the witness list. The imposition of more costly, time-consuming, and disruptive procedures will only hinder peer review. One might ask, for example, why a physician should have access to the complaints that the hospital found unsubstantiated and doesn't rely on. Harassment, retaliation, or at best, impaired working relationships with the people who filed the complaint could certainly be expected. A statement of the bases of the charges that the hospital already has to supply should be sufficient. The people who have to sit on these peer review committees are volunteers, virtually sort of drafted volunteers under the statute, but volunteers nonetheless. They don't get paid. They're physicians who have to take time out of their practice to do this activity. Subjecting them to subpoenas for depositions, hearings, and trials is certainly not going to encourage them to participate more fully in the process. And it seems to me the process is totally unnecessary. If a state employee gets fired and has all the due process rights in the world, that employee does not get the right to subpoena witnesses and documents. That employee gets the right to hear what the charges are and to present evidence to refute them. And that is already assured to physicians in this state. The discovery process that's proposed is quite one-sided. It says the physician under challenge, not the colleagues who accuse him, not the hospital, gets to issue subpoenas for documents or demands for documents. The physician under challenge, not his accusers, not the hospital, can subpoena witnesses. And it doesn't deal at all with those many practitioners who I think are probably a lot more subject to potential discrimination in peer review than physicians will ever be, because the peer review process is for the most part conducted by physicians. The people who really would have something to fear in the process are the non-physicians coming through the system. They aren't covered by this bill at all. Given the extensive procedural protections and mechanisms already in the federal law, I think the discovery part of this bill is not only unnecessary but disruptive. As a bill aimed at getting immunity, it does have some purpose. I think you can deal far more directly with the immunity question, though. First of all, there's federal and state causes of action. If you want to deal with state causes of action, it's real simple. Pass a bill that says peer review is defined broadly to include all these kinds of processes and all the people who participate in them and sit on the committees or assist the committees and supply advice, and those people are all immune, period. There won't be a state cause of action. In that case, an aggrieved practitioner who thinks he's been wrongfully denied, railroaded out of town, would have his court appeal, as he already does, to contest the procedure and show that the people didn't give him a chance to present his side of the story, didn't tell him what the charges were, whatever the assertions are, why he's been deprived of fair process. But he wouldn't have a lawsuit in the sense of filing a damage claim. What you can do about the federal causes of action is far more limited, obviously. Congress has definitely made some policy choices in terms of what it would give immunity for and what it wouldn't. Really, the only one that I see a means to attack, should you choose to attack it, is the one Senator Shoemaker pointed out, which is that the antitrust laws, not the civil rights laws, not all the other things one might be sued for, handicap rights and so on, but the antitrust laws have a narrow exception for state action. And it's basically that the courts have construed that the Congress didn't intend to apply antitrust laws to those circumstances where the state said you have to do this anti-competitive looking activity and we're going to supervise it to see you do it right. If in fact you have a clearly articulated and actively supervised process, you would get the immunity under the federal statute. So in that case, I certainly agree with your analysis, Senator Shoemaker. What I think is a problem, though, is whether it's worth the price and whether that's the best way to get the immunity, if that's the goal. The problems with the immunity part of the proposal are these. I have trouble understanding why one would take action to close off federal antitrust actions when you leave the state antitrust actions, which are parallel, wide open. It seems to me a bit incongruous. This bill removes from the hands of Oregon's private as well as public hospitals a vital and fundamental part of their property rights, the right to set their own standards, make their own decisions about who's going to get access and use their facilities and on what conditions. It substitutes circuit court judges making de novo decisions to supplant those of hospitals. And it does so despite leaving in place ORS 441, that's the licensing chapter's, requirements that the hospitals be responsible for those decisions and liable for the results if they don't do it right. I think if passed, this bill would in fact result in the demise of effective peer review. It might provide immunity from the federal antitrust claims, leaving all those other kinds of claims out there, but it would also make hospital peer review downright superfluous. From the volunteer physician's point of view, why go through all this process? Why really put your heart into it if some judge with no medical training is free to totally ignore the result? And if the bill is restricted, as Mr. Cooney has just suggested, it's unnecessary. You can already take to court a procedural, purely procedural review. Did you follow the bylaws? Did you give fair notice and process? It puts the courts in the position of having to exercise medical expertise that they don't have. It asks them to impose that decision on unwilling colleagues and hospital personnel who have to work with a physician day to day after having found that he is unacceptable in some way to their standards. It often will expose them to joint liability for working with that very physician they would not have chosen to work with voluntarily. And it's a very expensive way to resolve credentials disputes. Under this bill, physicians get the full panoply of the federal fair process proceedings and then can ignore the result and stack on top of it, go to court de novo, and start all over trying to reach a contrary result. I think it's important that you understand what goes on in the hospital now. There are just multiple layers of procedures before you ever get to the end of a peer review process. If a colleague sees someone doing something that is, he's become erratic and incompetent and apt to injure patients, first the colleague files the complaint and requests the review. An investigating committee gets appointed, goes out and digs up the facts. That then comes back to either a department in some larger hospitals or an executive committee in a small hospital. Gets reviewed again with physician input. He doesn't like the result, it goes to a full-blown hearing. Lawyers and the whole court reporters and everything in attendance. He doesn't like the result, then he gets an appeal. If he doesn't like that result, he gets to go to the hospital board. And that's usually civic members. So there's lots of processes before we get there. The court process is only going to add another level. It's going to slow it down. A lot more time between the time decisions are needed and the time they're made. And I think it's going to set people up, while protecting them from the federal cause, for state causes of action for bad faith if that decision is reversed de novo. If something more is really needed to protect the public here, and if immunity is the goal, state action does not require court action. It just requires that the state get active in reviewing the process. Wouldn't something like the Board of Medical Examiners, with the privacy that that agency has, with the medical expertise that that agency have, make a lot more sense if the state chooses to get into the business of reviewing all these peer review decisions? Peer review works now because it's done by knowledgeable professionals and because it's done in private, not in open court. Colleagues are not willing to come forward with criticism if doing so gets them entangled in legal proceedings, whether they're there as witnesses or as defendants. So I guess in sum, I think this proposal doesn't gain us a whole lot, but I think it costs us an awful lot. It costs us loss of control of standards, it costs us confidentiality, it costs us time, it costs us money, and it costs us harassment and an invasion of the time of peer review members, additional burdens on them. If the state wants to take charge of the peer review process, there are much simpler ways at your disposal. Use the Board of Medical Examiners, tighten licensing requirements, license review mechanisms, funnel all these reports to the State Board of Medical Examiners, who probably has a considerable amount of interest in them anyway. So if you decide to take over the process and to accept the costs and the responsibilities that go with it, that seems to me a more logical way to do it than setting up a court review process. If the state does not want to take over peer review, then I think this bill deserves a quick burial.
Questions?
Yes.
Any questions? No. Thank you. Thank you very much. Anyone else to speak to 1053? Okay, now I'd like to turn to a work session here, folks, before we begin to... Yes, we want to make sure we have full complement of folks here. Senate Bill 382.
Thank you.
This bill has been here over and over and over again, but it's back.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
It's back.
I have
it's
the
back.
Dash 4 amendments that I will pass out.
Right? It is back.
If we just had a policy of tabling anything with more than dash 2, I would think we'd go much quicker.
Look, the staff, Bill Taylor has worked and worked and worked on this. Other people have. Actually, it was on the shelf until folks decided to try to make another go at reviving it.
And they did a good job.
Okay, yes. And Bill, are you ready?
Sure, I'm sure. Madam Chair, members of the committee, this bill was last before us on March 11th for a work session, at which time we adopted a set of amendments, and these amendments are basically embodied in the dash 4 amendments you see in front of you that dated 4891. Basically, what the amended bill does is clarify that line of credit instruments apply to both commercial and consumer loans. The payments made for insurance and taxes have priority status. The maturity date of a loan must be disclosed in the front of the line of credit agreement. The line of credit instrument may be used in secured agreements other than mortgages, i.e. trust deeds, and that loan advances may be made above the face amount of the instrument without the advances losing their priority status over subsequent loans if the loan is being made on a commercial property for construction purposes. Basically, what the last amendments did was to make sure that this did not apply to residential line of credit instruments. And line of credit instrument applies to a residential property, which means four or fewer residents, one of which is owner-occupied.
These amendments actually were here in a non-LC form last time, and we got embroiled in one little phrase that they decided at the last minute they were going to take out because it was arcane language that was repetitive, but it is here. I think Frank is gone. Do you have questions? Anyone have questions that they want to direct? Mr. Bronner is here.
Mm-hmm.
Not an extension of the Oregon Bar Association, right?
Honorary member.
Anyone like to move the dash 4 amendments?
I move the dash 4 amendments.
Okay. Senator Hill has moved the dash 4 amendments just to make sure that they are exactly conforming to what we adopted in concept last time around. Are there objections to Senator Hill's motion? Hearing none, so ordered. Okay. Senator Blunt, are you satisfied with this bill at this point?
Yes.
Are you willing to move it to the floor?
I move it to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
As amended.
As amended.
All right. Senator Bond has moved Senate Bill 382 to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended.
No priority reporting.
Discussion. Call the roll, please.
Senator Ben.
Aye.
Senator Hamby.
Aye.
Senator Shoemaker.
Aye.
Senator Springer.
Aye.
Vice Chair Hill.
Aye.
Chair Cohen.
Aye. Motion carried. Thank you very much. Okay, we do have a bill introduction.
Oh, God.
At the request of the Oregon Bankers Association.
Your timing is impeccable.
Requiring the award of attorney fees to the party filing action and interpleader. Actually, this went through the Rules Committee, and we said we'd introduce it. There are some people who believe, Frank, you don't need this, but we'll consider it. We'll see what we're going to do about it. Are there objections to this LC 3978 being introduced as a committee bill at the request of the Oregon Bankers Association? Hearing none, so ordered. As I say, there are people who say it's probably not necessary to do this. We'll find out. Thank you. Now let's move to Senate Bill 681. Bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have amendments. We last heard this bill on March 20th, and after the hearing, I went over the bill with the Legislative Counsel's Office, Dave Hendricks, and together we have put together an amendment, the Dash 1 amendments, and I have an engrossed version, which I'd like to pass out and then explain.
Okay. You recall this was at the request of the Association of Retired Persons dealing with powers of attorney, and I remember Senator Shoemaker said, well, we can record powers of attorney in the land property statutes, whatever they are. We had some questions about whether you could, how to get it off and how to change it, and we'll see where we are with it.
Okay.
Right? At least that's my recollection of it.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, one of the concerns that I've had, and Dave Hendricks, when he looked at it, agrees with me, that is the fact that when you are asked to record the revocation in the county clerk's office records, you now raise the issue of constructive notice. The fact that even though someone doesn't know about it, they are held to know the fact that it has been revoked, which this could result in someone going to, say, a bank with a power of attorney, and the bank officer feeling very, very uncomfortable with that power of attorney because in the county records there may be a revocation filed, which would be binding upon him as a revocation would be, say, when you relate to real property. But when you're dealing with real property, you're expected to deal with the county land records, and when you file, you will go down there. What we did on the revocation of power of attorney was basically make it applicable only if you have actual notice. Revocation, if I may read, we're taking out subsection 2 of the bill, and then deleting lines 7 through 9, and then adding a new subsection 2 of section 2. Revocation of power of attorney may be recorded in the county clerk's office of the same county where the power of attorney was recorded, but revocation does not revoke or terminate the agency as to the attorney in fact who, without actual knowledge of the revocation, acts in good faith under the power of attorney. So that if you had someone with the power of attorney who did not know that revocation was filed, they could still act. And in doing so, could still bind someone, or could enter an agreement or a contract with a party who would also see that power of attorney and not have any knowledge of it. In addition, nor does a recording of revocation affect the validity of any transaction entered into under the power of attorney if the person entering into the transaction with the power of attorney, in fact, did not have actual knowledge of the revocation. So that if you were that bank officer, and if someone came in with a copy of the power of attorney, notarized copy of the power of attorney, certified from the county clerk's office, that bank attorney could rely on that in good faith without having to do something which may be almost impossible, and that would be to go down to the county clerk's office and check to see if revocation were filed.
Okay, probably the best we could do under the circumstances. Appreciate Bill's work on it. Let's see where we are with it, committee.
Madam Chair.
Senator Shoemaker.
This final sentence of the amendment troubles me, and I guess we need to think it through. That is, the recording of a revocation doesn't affect the validity of a transaction entered into if the person entering into the transaction did not know of the revocation, which means that even if the holder of the power knew of the revocation and revocation was recorded, he could, in bad faith, albeit enter into a transaction with an innocent third party and bind the principal.
Correct.
That's troubling. I mean, you have one thing for the attorney, in fact, to be acting in good faith without knowledge, another for him to be acting in bad faith and binding the principal nonetheless.
What happens now? Do you know what happens now with the power of attorney sort of floating around and not recorded?
I think the transaction...
If you have, for example, no attorney involved, as you would in the district court case, there are small claims courts, it becomes quite difficult. And you can hang up a whole real estate transaction for some entirely innocent person because we don't know who they are. The other problem is you can have a person who's paid off their judgment, but they were naive and they didn't get a satisfaction recorded. The creditor has disappeared, and so we're simply going to say, you know, we can't insure this matter. We can't insure over it. The rules are quite strict with the real estate commissioner, especially recently. We can't insure over judgments very easily. We're going to have to inform the buyer and the lender, and a lot of the lenders are very sensitive in the secondary market. And as a result, there are big problems for people who are entirely innocent. There is the method that we have already, and it works pretty well, I think, because you can take the district court judgments where there is a chance of getting the real property, and those can be rather easily transcribed to circuit court. That separates the wheat from the chaff. The whole issue is sort of a balancing act between the social good of creditors collecting their just debts and the burden to the system. And I think what has evolved over many years of having circuit court and district court types of dockets, one burdening real property and one not, is a pretty good system. That's all I had. If there's any questions,
Are there questions? Thank you very much. Anyone else to speak to this bill? Okay, let's move on to 722, our last bill of the evening. Steve Corey is here and company, who are supporters of this bill. I have James Marvin here signed up.
I assume so. That's a judgment.
Sure. Madam Chair, if we can come together,
great.
Please.
Yes, please.
Thank you.
It would be our pleasure.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Stephen Cafori. I represent the Architects and Engineers Legislative Council of Oregon, and I'm bringing you an old friend tonight. You first saw this bill, 1985. Senator Springer remembers in his youthful days in the House of Representatives
when
this first posed its head, and the last couple days of the legislature got tied up with a parliamentary game where somebody was trying to tie it onto another bill, and it failed. Through no fault of its own. We came back in 1979, at the end of 1987, the end of the 1987 session, there was a problem with the trial lawyers and tort reform, and this got caught up in the whirlwind of battles that had nothing again to do with this bill directly. last session, the chair will remember that the bill came over this committee in the last couple days of the session, and it was too late to do anything with the bill. So we've had this up before three times, and it's always gotten run or miss somewhere of the system, run afoul. And what I'm asking tonight, Madam Chair, members of the committee, is we've got it here in the middle of the session. We have lots of time. Let's take a look at the issue on its merits and pass the bill on its merits. It's interesting to me that you'll hear some testimony opposing this from Trial Lawyers Association, and I think, again, that the opposition to this kind of waxes and wanes on the season. When we first introduced this in 1985, the trial lawyers had no opposition to it at all, did not testify it, although they were well aware of it. It says to me that it's really more a question of what the political season brings to us and what other kinds of bills are in front of the legislature and what the success of a certain lobby has been or has failed to have been during the last couple of sessions, again, than on the merits of this bill. So let's take a look, Madam Chair, members of the committee, at Senate Bill 722. Let's find out exactly what it does and ask some questions about this bill, specifically in its merits.
Great. So tell us what it does.
Okay. Madam Chair and members, I am Jim Marvin. I'm an attorney in Portland. I have devoted my professional career towards the representation of designers, specifically architects and engineers in Oregon and in Southwest Washington. I am here today on behalf of the Consulting Engineers Council of Oregon, the Oregon Council of Architects, and the Oregon Association of Defense Counsel to endorse Senate Bill 722. I just received, it was faxed, fortunately, to Steve at my request, a statement, a position paper from the Oregon Association of Defense Counsel. And I'd like to take a moment to read that position paper. The OADC supports Senate Bill 722 to modify the statute of limitations for certain causes of action arising out of improvements to real property. The modifications would clarify the time within which affected persons may bring a claim and bring architects and other professionals more in line with other persons who are involved in construction of improvements to real property. It would clarify both for architects and other professionals who are involved in the early stages of a project and for the purchasers of their services the time period within which problems must be handled and thus allow those persons to plan their business affairs with more certainty. Signed, James Bartles, Chair, OADC Trade Regulation Unfair Competition Committee. For us to talk about what change Senate Bill 722 will have, we must first understand ORS 12-135 in its present form. ORS 12-135 in its present form has no statute of limitations, none. It does have a statute of ultimate repose. The statute of ultimate repose is 10 years from the date of substantial completion of a project. What that means, simply stated, is that a designer must keep his files for approximately 14 years. A designer in this state, an architect or engineer, occupies a unique status in our community. An architect or engineer has the longest statute of ultimate repose than any other person, group, or organization in this state. Right now, the doctors, as an example, they have a five-year ultimate repose, 5 years from the date of surgical procedure or act complained of. We have lawyers that are 10 years from the date of the negligent act. We have manufacturers under our products liability law that is 8 years from the date that the product is first sold for use or consumption. Everyone else in this state, everyone else other than architects and engineers, and other than those that I have mentioned, have a 10-year statute of ultimate repose from the date of the negligent act. An architect or engineer could conceivably, and in many cases does, have a statute of ultimate repose of 14 or more years from the date of the negligent act, because the occurrence keying the ultimate repose is the date of substantial completion of the project. The prime example of that is the construction that's ongoing of the state office building. in Portland, the new state office building. I had the pleasure, perhaps, or perhaps displeasure, of negotiating the design contracts on that design-build project. I did that over 2 years ago. The substantial completion isn't going to be for another year. The architect and other designers, including soils engineers, must maintain their files for 14 years from the date that they perform their professional services, unlike any other person in this state. As to the statute of limitations under our existing clause, the statute of limitations of an architect or engineer is directly dependent upon the pleading ability of the attorney bringing the action. It is dependent upon the nature of the action and the kind of damages that are being sought. If it is being sued for negligence, typically you must bring that lawsuit within 2 years from the date that the injury or damage is first noted. And that only applies to claims of economic loss. If it's other damage to real property, it's 6 years. If you want to sue for breach of contract, it's 6 years. So, once again, I emphasize that there is no, and I emphasize again, no statute of limitations for a designer in this state. Yet the present statute simply throws it in to other provisions of ORS Chapter 12. The result of having no statute of limitations for designers is that it calls upon the court to look at the claim being brought in the pleading by the plaintiff to try to determine the nature of that cause of action. And therefore, we do not get uniform decisions. One judge may say it is a breach of contract, and another one under the Securities Intermountain case, an opinion written a few years ago by Hans Justice Lundy, may very well call it a breach of contract or a negligence or something in between. The proposed statute, which is Senate Bill 722, clarifies that. It, for the first time since 1981, will give a definitive statute of limitations to a designer. And secondly, it will give a more appropriate...
Tell us what it is.
It is 2 years from the date that the injury or damage is known or should have been known.
Oh, should have been known.
That's right. That imposes upon a landowner or a property owner a duty to observe or inspect.
What if in the case of the school that the beams fell in and out in Sandy or out somewhere in East County, our East County?
It was over near Pendleton, and I handled the case. It was at Athena.
Yeah, how could I have known as a school board member?
How would a school board member know?
Or a school board person who would know to know that this, that's the part that bothers me.
Okay. Typically, buildings fail within two weather seasons in this state. Normally, in two weather seasons of this state, the building will have been loaded to all anticipated loads. And in the case of Athena, you would have had the snow load. You would have had, in that particular location, a requirement of drifting snow load, unlike what we would have in many of our roofs here. We would also have all of the necessary weather patterns.
Yeah, I'm having problems with in this bill is it should have known. I mean, I don't mind limitations on the time that it happened, but should
understand,
have known,
Madam
no
Chair,
problem.
From the date that it fell in, they got 2 years to bring their lawsuit.
Okay. That's not from the time when the building is finished. That's from the time that the roof caves in. So right. They can figure out probably within 2 years if the roof fell in or didn't
absolutely.
Fall in.
But not more than 6 years after it's built.
After the substantial completion. And the reason that we have the date of 6 years from the date of substantial completion, this date makes sense. And the reason it makes sense is that after the substantial completion, the designers leave. They're gone. The contractor, he leaves. He's gone. The building is turned over to the owner. The longevity of that building from that day forward is directly dependent upon the degree of maintenance that is afforded that building by the owner. As an example, and perhaps the best example, is a landslide. We have a building being built upon soils. At the time that the building is built, the soils are satisfactory. After the building is built and gone, we have the landowner, as an example, changing the flow of the natural drainage of the water. he can install, as an example, a sprinkler system. You can have further development in the area that will further undermine the soils. And then, in a few years, typically within a couple of seasons, you have a failure. Is that a failure as a result of a designer's action, or is that a failure as a result of change conditions and or failure to maintain the premises? Classic example is gutters around the foundation of a building. You have to maintain them. You don't maintain them, they overflow. The water gets around your foundation, and it can cause differential settlement around your spread footings. That's strictly a maintenance item.
Madam Chair.
Senator Vaughn.
Well, I understand that those are maintenance items, and you could make the case in court that the landowner was at fault, and therefore there shouldn't be a judgment. But if after 7 years the roof simply collapses and it wasn't the owner's fault, you're saying you don't even have the right to argue that.
No, I'm not saying that I do not have the right to argue that. Of course I would argue that that becomes a maintenance problem.
No, I'm sorry. In the case where the maintenance was done,
okay,
the design was flawed and the roof collapsed after 7 years.
The issue here is, Madam Chair, Senator Mann, that design flaws of the nature of roofs falling down appear about 90% during construction. And they happen the next 90%, because geometric progression, the next 90% of those will happen within the first year. By the time you get out 7 years from now and the roof falls in, it's not a design problem anymore, because what would cause a roof to fall in, inadequate weight, or inadequate design for a weight, for example, or the improper materials used, those things show up right away. And this is historically, around the country, this has been shown. That if something happens 7 years later, it isn't a result of design, because design flaws show up before 7 years. If you had something 7 years later, there's some other cause. And the problem is, Senator Bunn, that...
Okay, so, Stephen, what you're saying is you take the 90%, and you say once we've hit 6 years, it's impossible for that to be a design error that has caused the problem, and therefore the courts have no jurisdiction on it. I find, you can look at a storm and you can say, well, the storm doesn't come by, the same frequency. But you can blame the weather and it was an act of God, or you can say maybe that design was insufficient and it took a little bit stronger wind than we normally get to show that. But you're denying the owner the opportunity to even argue that.
Okay. Well, Senator Hill has a question.
Yes, you mentioned the length of, is there any other statute of limitations that's 2 years?
Any other statute of limitations? Yes, for a personal injury from an automobile accident or a slip and fall on the premises, those are kinds of actions that must be brought within 2 years.
Well, I think they're going to know when they get hurt. They fall down. But I'm thinking... even with a car, a car's, most of them are 3 years of 50,000, some of them are 3 years and 50,000 miles beginning to end, complete everything. And I could probably, not that I know a lot about a car, but I probably can see a lot more and get an idea of what's going wrong with a car a lot more maybe than my house, if you built a house for me. It just seems like 2 years is a very, very short period of time.
The 2 years is the date that you first noticed the damage. Actually, it's 6 years after you move in. You've got a chance to determine if there's something wrong with the house. So you've got 6 years.
But as the chair mentioned, it says something to the effect of known or should have known.
I think you have to distinguish between the statute of limitations and the statute of repose. The statute of limitations is a time after you discover there's a problem within which you have time to sue. The ultimate pose is that if the time starts running from the building being completed.
Well, may I ask a question? Now, suppose then that I'm having a problem and I discover the problem and I try to work with someone to get the problem solved. Could that couldn't that go on for a period of time? I mean, for 2 years, trying to get something, get the problem rectified?
Yes, it could. And during that time period, you should either have it rectified or you would have to file your lawsuit, similar to a car accident case. You know that you were hurt at the date of the accident, and you then have 2 years then to perfect your claim either through settlement or filing a lawsuit. And it's the same that we're talking about here. Once you know that you've been damaged or have reason to know that you've been damaged, that's what keys the 2 years.
So you mean you'd rather somebody just file the suit and not take the chance rather than try to work it out? I mean, I'm talking about a layperson, and we're talking about property here, not a situation where you're physically injured, where I think people understand. I think they have a better idea that a lawsuit is liable, more likely to come out of that situation than someone who's trying to get something done with their, you know, with their home. And just the two-year period just seems, because when you're talking about real property, I mean, I don't know what, maybe a lot of people when they, after their house is done, they get and crawl under it and all of that stuff. I think maybe I've been under my house very few times. I don't really like to do that. And I guess you're really putting quite a, I mean, 2 years just seems very, like a very, very short period of time. For something like real property. And I have trouble equating it to personal injury.
It may be instructive to look at other states that are our neighbors, certainly not compelling, but it may be instructive to find out what they're doing. And I would refer the chairwoman and the members to Washington. RCW 4.16.310 deals with architects and engineers in the state of Washington. And that one states, in the state of Washington, all claims or causes of action shall accrue and the applicable statute of limitations shall begin to run only during the period within 6 years, 6 years after substantial completion, which is what we're asking for here. You've got 6 years after it's done, and then to notice the damage, and then once you've noted the damage, you've got 2 years to resolve it or file the lawsuit.
Well, is it a six-year in Washington, a six-year statute of limitations, or is that the statute?
That's an ultimate repose of 6 years. You have 3 years from the date.
Well, do they have a statute of limitations?
3 years from the date that they first note damage.
So it's 3 years in Washington.
It's 3 and 6 in Washington.
So is there any state then that has something? What else is 2 years? What other state has 2 years?
Okay, the majority of the states in the United States. 47 states have statutes of limitation and statute of ultimate repose. Only 3 states have none. Okay.
Yes, I'm saying right. What's the length?
Okay, and the average length is 6 years ultimate repose, and it varies state to state. I'd have to, right, if you're going to look for a mean, at about 2.5 years on a statute of limitations. California is 1 year from the date that you first noticed the damage, and you got 4 years on a patent defect to bring a lawsuit, and if it's a latent defect, you have 10 years. So California gets it a little more involved. They talk about whether or not it's latent or patent defect. Okay. Yeah. So California, once you've known the defect in California, you got 1 year to bring it. Once you know the defect in Washington, you got 3 years to bring it. Okay. I hope I haven't confused you. Pardon?
Let's move on. We've got Senator Bunn has a question, and then we'll gather this information that we can gather.
Okay, I'm not as troubled by the 2 years as I am the six. I know in the church that I'm a part of, when it was built, the roofers didn't place the screws right. Well, the roofing didn't blow off in the first storm that came about, but the potential was there. A warehouse that I've got, the roofers put the nails in the valley instead of the ridge. And in the first 6 years, it didn't leak, but I know good and well that it's going to be defective. But you're telling me as long as it makes it through 6 years, it's okay?
From the date of substantial completion, because that's when most of the failures occur.
Okay, so even if I have a roof with a 20-year guarantee, and, well, forget the guarantee, just coming back to the, most of the failures occur, but those that don't have a right. Mine was an example, and it hasn't failed yet because I paid somebody to go up and check it out and do some more work on it. But that is an example where I believe that it will fail before it reasonably should, because someone did not follow the manufacturer's directions. Shouldn't I have a right after the 6 years to deal with that when, in fact, it does fail?
Yeah, and I would remind everybody, Bill, you might, for the record, add that this doesn't apply just to architects. It does apply to construction.
Right.
Yeah, to contractors as well.
Contractors and the whole myriad. Bill, why don't you?
Sure, Madam Chair. I just want to let everyone know that line A clearly states persons having performed the construction, alteration, repair, or improvement to real property. Yeah. So that would include general contractors, subcontractors, as well as other professionals involved.
Madam Chair, if you'd like to just strike that out and leave it with architects and engineers, it wouldn't bother us one bit.
Senator Shoemaker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You had to make a choice between your two-year statute of limitations or your six-year statute of repose. Which is more important to you?
2 years. Let there be no doubt, Senator.
I thought you. Yeah.
Not even close. We have to have some consistency.
10-year statute of ultimate repose, same as you have now. But you'd like a 2-year statute of limitations once something is found or should have been found.
Absolutely. That would be my choice. No question. The other problem really deals in a practical matter of trying to preserve all of the files, and then architects, when they get ready to retire, unlike we poor lawyers, they have to carry a tail of professional liability insurance, sometimes for as long as 18 years, and gets to be very expensive. I would further point out that architects and engineers pay the highest rate for any professional person in our state. They pay between 5% and 12% of their annual gross for professional liability insurance coverage. And those policies carry an average deductible of $25,000.
Okay, I'm going to move you on because okay. We have the opposition here and we want to get out of here tonight.
All right.
But
before the place falls.
I think he's in the wings lately. Anyway, so I guess I'd have to summarize and then move to the next person.
We do have a couple of extra things in there, Madam Chair, smaller points such as if a building, if the financing ran out and the building were never completed, the statute of repose would never start. So we'd like to put in substantial completion or abandonment.
Okay. Anything else?
Excuse me. My name is Alan Kostick. I'm a Salem architect and current president-elect of Oregon Council of Architects. And I'd like to touch on the last point that we were talking about here, Madam Chair and members of the committee, and that is the succession of ownership. My partner and I, we were junior partners in a firm here in Salem, and 2 years ago, we bought the ownership from the senior partner. The firm at that time had a 31-year history. It now has a 33-year history. One of the biggest issues that our senior partner had to deal with was twofold. One, to make sure that we continued to succeed, primarily because he needed to protect his liability tail as he left. Essentially, at retirement at age 67, he had no guarantee that he would never be sued again on something he may have done 20 years previously. That is not a very comforting situation for any professional to leave their practice at. So I'm not really speaking for myself at this point, but I'm speaking for the older members of our profession who have to deal with this retirement issue. How do they retire with safety and security? And I think this bill certainly addresses that. And it is true that liability insurance is the single biggest item that we pay each year. Again, we're a 33-year-old business in this community. We have never had to deal with a liability issue in our firm in its 33-year history, yet we still pay $30,000 a year. That's a tremendous burden on our profession and a tremendous burden for the people leaving our profession at retirement. That's all I have to say.
I guess doesn't that the fact your insurance requirements though reflect the nature of what you do? I mean, real property is a long-term, long-lasting thing. I mean, it's not like a car. It's not like personal injury. It's you have how real property, buildings, homes, they last a long time.
to summarize again, Madam Chair, Senator Hill, they do last a long time if they're designed properly. If they're not designed properly, that shows up very quickly. If something goes wrong with them 8 or 10 years down the road, that's not the problem of the designer. That's the problem of the maintenance of the house or of an act of God, if you will. And the problem is that what we face at that time, as you remember from law school, lawyers are never taught that the first job is to find out who's at fault and only sue that person. What they're taught in law school is to sue everyone in sight. It's the shotgun. And so what happens is that somebody has some problem with real property, you name the architect and you name the engineer because they're part of the game. And our insurance typically does not cover our defense costs, and so even if we go in and say, look, we had nothing to do with that problem, it's obviously a problem of maintenance, we still are stuck with, you know, $4,000 or so to make that point. And we have had situations of engineers, I won't tonight, but I'll tell you about some stories about companies going out of business because of that problem. There can be a deep pocket.
And then I want to wind this up to give.
I'm not quite clear. Two witnesses have testified to it. I'm not quite clear why you're hanging out there 20 years from the time you can finish your work and how you'd be protected by this by any more than 4 years.
All right. I'll be happy to answer that. First of all, from the time that the design is done and the building is built, can be 3 or 4 years. The ultimate repose right now for architects and engineers is 10 years from the date of substantial completion. The design, the negligent act, was 4 years before that. So now it's 14 years from the date of the negligent act. Now, shortly before the ultimate repose runs out, the owner sues the contractor. The contractor then takes it through the court and gets an adverse judgment.
Okay.
Then he sues for indemnity.
So really all this does is it shortens whatever that period is by 4 years. Your 10 years down to 6 years cuts 4 years off of that.
It cuts the 20 years down to...
Well, it was 20 years.
I would also point out that Senate Bill 722 also applies actions for contribution and indemnity into ORS 18.440. So it also addresses the latter issue of later filed actions for indemnity, which according to the Owens versus Rose A case must be brought within 6 years after the contractor gets stuck and pays.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you. Charlie Williamson, and then we're going to hear from the people from Eugene who've come up, Somerset Hills, the homeowners.